Baseball fans, BetMGM is giving you the chance to win a prize every day during the baseball season. Step into the batter's box for BetMGM's Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. Pick any area of the strike zone and take your best swing. If you get a single, double, triple, or home run, you'll receive a prize. Smash a home run to collect a bonus bet on us. Just log into your BetMGM Sports account to get started. Then visit your promotion section to access the Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. You'll score a prize if you hit a single, double, triple, or home run. There's nothing more exciting than going yard, so swing for the fences with the king of sportsbooks. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. Must be 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards vary depending on the market and expire 24 hours from issuance. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.
You're listening to the Afterburn Podcast, episode number 3.
Altitude.
Tower Demire Stations, release to you, runway 4 left, wind 040 at 5, clear for takeoff.
Sea tide, Altitude 0 eyes, we're clear for takeoff, clear for the airspace.
Fire protector, low speed, left front,
Viper and Raptor,
pulse
at 354.
Viper 01, be advised, the restricted 6002 is still active.
I get out and, right before I get out, I'm doing the system check. I'm like, all right, well, I can feel my toes. I got arms. I can see, and I can see a hole in my goggles. So I'm like, well, I'm seeing the hole, so we're good there. And then, like, starting to check all my teeth, jaw, like, you know, doing this in 5 seconds, right? And I'm like, got a lot of blood coming out of my head and my mouth. Well, I'm good for now. So I get out, go to shoulder my rifle to shoot whoever's running away from the scene, right?
So that's the voice of Steve Reichert, who's the guest on today's podcast. And he's talking about his experience immediately following his vehicle rolling over an IED. Steve is credited with a kill of over 1,600 meters when he was fighting some insurgents in Iraq in 2004. He has done some incredible things, not only in his Marine Corps career, but post-Marine Corps career. He's staying pretty busy. He's going to talk a little bit about that on the podcast today, which I think you'll find fascinating as we take a different perspective and we're looking from the ground up. Before we get rolling in the podcast today, a few admin notes. I would like to thank my Patreon supporters. Again, just created that account over at patreon.com/theafterburnpodcast. For those of you that are looking for some additional content or looking to get involved in some of the episode development, joining at the punk level, I'd like to thank Kenneth Dahl, Kent Bell, Standing Cow, and then the Fighter Pilot Podcast for their support. The next level, the Patch, Kurt Billard and William Kwan. And finally, at the Director of Ops level, Luis Cerda. Patreon gives me another opportunity there to put content out. You're going to get episodes right when they release. They're unedited. When you join like the Director of Ops level, you're going to be able to see who's coming on the show and ask questions. So if you're looking for more content, swing over to patreon.com/theafterburnpodcast. And finally, I'd like to thank my sponsor for today's episode, Wingman Watches. Swing over to wingmanwatch.com if you're looking to build a custom watch for your group, your organization. Again, military, fire, police, a sports organization, whatever it might be. If you have a group and you want a custom watch, they're the place to go because you're going to get a timepiece with Swiss movements that's custom built for you and your team that you absolutely love at a fraction of the cost that you'll pay elsewhere. It's a veteran-owned company, veteran-run. Again, you won't be disappointed. Swing over to wingmanwatch.com. They already have some watches over there that if you like, you can use the code RAIN10 and get 10% off your order. Well, with all the admin knocked out, over to today's podcast with retired Marine Steve Reichert. I hope you enjoy. And again, wherever you're listening, hit subscribe and leave me a review. it really helps out with the podcast. So with that said, over to the interview. Well,
yeah,
you ready to get after this?
Oh yeah, whenever you are, dude.
Boom. Well, Steve, thanks for joining me on the podcast. Excited to hear a little bit about your journey and where you are today, as well as some of the stuff you've done in the past. Before we get rolling into that, why don't you tell everyone a little bit about who you are, where you come from, and what you're doing today?
Yeah, so Steve Reichert, originally from Boston area, jumped into the Marines in 98, did almost 8 years to the day before getting medically retired. Did a few things after that with on the private sector with government programs, training companies, and spend most of my time these days up in D.C. working on other government programs, just trying to connect dots and make things happen for the boss.
No, that's awesome. I know one of the big things that you're doing that is kind of a volunteer, not necessarily a work aspect, although it is work, is the Brothers in Arms Foundation. Can you tell me a little bit about the Brothers in Arms Foundation?
Yeah, so that's the foundation got established in 2009, so pushing 11 years now, to support the Marine Special Operations community and their families, where the government kind of leaves off. You know, the DOD can do tremendous things, but at some point, like, their support needs to cut off. So the foundation sort of fills the gaps and doing everything from tuition assistance for Gold Star family members, moving folks around the country, you know, taking care of mortgages, building houses, you know, you name it, and everything in between, just to make the lives a little bit easier for those Gold Star family members, or even the active duty guys. If I think it was last year, there were two guys overseas in Iraq that got notified that, you know, their wives are going into labor, and the command gave them the time off to get back home, but, you know, they had to pay for their commercial flights out of Iraq. So little tiny things like that, you know, picking up things short notice, you know, whatever we can do to help make life easier for those in the community, that's where we focus on.
Yeah, that's awesome. So Brothers in Arms Foundation, if people are looking to support veterans or even active duty members who might need some help, go over and check that out. And I imagine, obviously, your time in the Marine Corps led to the drive to create the Brothers in Arms Foundation. Can you tell me, when did you join the Marine Corps? What was some of the decision that went into you wanting to pursue that? Yeah,
so this rolls back to maybe I was 5 or 6. I was sitting in a small little suburban town outside of Boston, watching a train go through town, and on somewhere in the middle of the train, there was a flat car with an old Sherman tank on it, right? And I'm probably going to a museum or something. I saw that thing roll by. I was like, I want to drive that, right? So I guess that started – I was focused on the military after that. And then maybe when I was 10 or 11, I saw a Marine in dress blues somewhere in town. I was like, that is awesome. And from that point on, I kind of started focusing on the Marines, and that was the end of it. So joined when I was 17, went into the infantry. Initially, was out in California for a few years, then got selected for the Marine Embassy Guard program, did 3 tours overseas in St. Petersburg, Russia, Karachi, Pakistan, Istanbul, Turkey, picked up a meritorious staff sergeant, 4 years, which is kind of quick. So when I did get back to the fleet rain, when I left the fleet, you know, I was a corporal, fire team leader, squad leader, et cetera. And when I came back, I was a platoon sergeant. So some of my fire team leaders were actually a year or two older than me. So it was a little bit odd, but it was a good career. And then, a few deployments overseas. I was out in Iraq in 2004 as a platoon sergeant. The History Channel did a spot on that. That was an interesting deployment, to say the least.
Yeah, I'd definitely like to talk about that in a minute, but I didn't realize you were an embassy guard. How was the 3 tours? Those are 3 unique and interesting places to be stationed.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So back then, I mean, they changed things up now. Back then, you had 2 tours, you know, 15-month tours, but Karachi, Pakistan was a hardship tour, obviously, and I got there maybe 2 months, 3 months prior to 9/11. So Being in the middle of the Hornet's nest for 9/11 was, you know, very unique. Obviously, the threat levels went up, but just seeing the folks celebrating in the streets as the towers were falling, it was like semi-depressing, but we pushed through it and then helped get all the other government groups into the country and get them across the border almost 3 weeks later. So it was interesting seeing all this transpire in front of your eyes. You're not really read in on what was going on, but you just see all the moving parts throughout the embassies and the consulates. And, you know, years later when things come out in other people's books, you know, putting two and two together was like, I know those guys. That's not their real name, but those guys were awesome and they drank heavily, right?
Yeah. Did you live in the embassy or did you guys live off the economy when you were stationed there?
Yeah. So in Karachi, we lived, there was an American compound, maybe straight shot 500 yards away from the consulate there. So technically it was out in town. There was a commute back and forth and we had a fully up armored, Chevy Suburban and typically would travel arm back and forth. So it got unique.
The security level, obviously after 9/11 ramped up, but was it busy there beforehand?
Not really. I mean, it's standard, you know, DEA flowing in and out, doing counter narcotics up in Peshawar and everywhere else. Wasn't too busy, but, you know, the consulate got blown up. I think a week before I left, right? You know, the regional security officer, RSO for State Department out there, one of the best guys out there, very forward thinking. He made sure that one side of the consulate where it was too close to the road, he couldn't do anything about it. He made sure that the entire side of the consulate was empty, despite State Department pushing back and complaining that they're doubling up on offices. But when that vehicle-borne IED went off and everything in those offices was shredded, you know, everybody praised him after that. So it was a unique tour, right? And from there, polar opposites, right? They got selected to go to St. Petersburg, Russia. So, you know, Korea, China, Russia, any of those higher counterintelligence threat posts, you know, you got to go back to Virginia for some additional training before you roll out. And I was out in Russia for almost 14 months and absolutely loved that tour. And it was awesome.
Yeah, I imagine completely unique and something different. And I'm imagining you're probably not blending in too well, at least in Karachi, maybe a little bit more in Russia, because I imagine you got a pretty good high and tight going on at that point.
In Russia, we actually blended in. It was a unique on the CI part because the Russians, FSB, you know, prior they were the KGB, their training academy was four blocks down from the consulate. So, you know, every American there, especially working for the consulate, had, you know, we were the guinea pigs for the new trainees all the time. So we just got used to life being watched at all times. But I had a unique opportunity while I was out there to go through the Russian Spetsnaz special, I think, subunit jump school out there. And while I was out there for the remainder of the tour, we pulled off 212 jumps with them, and awesome guys, crazy as hell. But it was definitely fun.
That's cool that you're able to do that. Cause you figure all the times, doing air shows is the only time I've actually interacted with other nations, and specifically like getting tours of like the Su-35 and with the chief test pilot for the Sukhoi Design Bureau. It's like in the end,
right,
no matter what, these guys are just pilots, and those guys, you know, they're just gun-toting dudes who are fighting for their country. But, you know, you put us all in the room, we're all kind of doing the same thing. Put it on the battlefield, it's another story. But
And it's just the way they do things, Rain. I mean, so when we learned how to pack parachutes, right, like they taught us how to do it, and we did it, you know, no issues whatsoever. When I got back to the U.S. and went to one of the local drop zones, they saw me trash packing the main, and they're like, what are you doing? I'm like, this is how you do it. It's not, they were very surprised that I was doing that. I mean, granted, it takes you like two and a half minutes to trash pack things, but, you know, little did I know. And another unique thing too about jumping out there is, you know, would never do this here in the U.S., but for every 100, 500, 1,000 jumps out there, if you're hitting any one of those wickets, you are taking a nice big bottle of vodka with you up in the stick, right? And as you're going up, you know, everybody's taking a swig and passing it right next to it. So you start with the back, right? Take a swig, pass it. Eventually it goes back to the front of the plane, right? Then you see the co-pilot put his arm back. It goes into the cockpit. The pilots take two heavy swigs and then it goes to the other side and just round and round until it's empty. And then they throw it out the back. So there's been a few times where I've been up. I don't really drink and I've been up at altitude because there are like four or five guys hitting those wickets. And like, I'm buzzed. And, you know, we're pushing out at 15K. I was like, this is not whatever. They're used to it, but this would never happen in America.
Yeah, this is how the story ends. What happened to Steve? Well, he went jumping with some Russians and into the ground he went. Yeah, whole nother right. world. Yeah, whole nother
too
world.
Drunk to pull.
Different worlds. Yeah, so worlds.
Yeah, no, I mean, it was a good tour. I mean, it's a good little program that the Marine Corps has. Yeah, very selective.
You wrap up your embassy tours. And then you are back home, and then you guys deploy, like you kind of alluded to, in 2004, you find yourself in Iraq. So I kind of want to talk a little bit, what was it like getting established there on the first deployment? How many times did you guys go out on patrol routinely, or what was that like?
Yeah, I mean, back then, again, this is like, what, a year after the initial push into Iraq happened. So everybody's still, for the most part, trying to figure their way around doing things in operations. So pretty much every day, the platoon, the company, we'd roll out on patrol. Unlike the Army, not bashing them that much, but at the time, they would just do vehicle patrols, and they would never step out of their Humvees. They never really got to know the locals. But at the time, Mattis and crew really wanted to establish a presence there. So aside from using the Humvees to get to a location, once we were in the small town or village, we were on foot patrolling around trying to interact with locals. They didn't always like us there, which, you know, me tossing myself in their shoes, I would agree. I mean, if foreigners were, you know, walking around Boston with guns, I probably wouldn't like them there as well. So, you know, it was interesting. I didn't get, there were firefights and IEDs almost weekly. Never expect, well, you join the Marines, right? What else are you going to do? But remember the first time we got into a rolling gun battle, my lieutenant, nice guy, but if you pictured the office manager Lumberg from Office Space, like that was my lieutenant. Like, again, super nice guy, but mannerisms, tone of voice, everything was like that. So we start getting sprayed one night with machine gun fire. We have tracers rolling overhead, and Lieutenant and I duck down, and I can see he's panicked. And I'm like, hey, sir, I think they're trying to kill us. Like, I'm laughing, and he's just not having any bit of, but, you know, there's occurrences like that weekly, and you just roll with the punches, right?
This mission I want to talk about, April 9th, 2004, Latafia. Were you guys pretty much in one village or one, you know, stay in the same AOR area of operations, or were you guys kind of roaming and tasked to different places?
Yeah. So that week there was a, I forget the name of the pilgrimage, but there a lot of locals were rolling up the main highway there, right, to get to another location. So the company was tasked in general with providing security in the general vicinity. And then my platoon, we were working out of an oil field for a few days, and the night prior to, April 8th, right? We launched a squad out there where the engagement happened the night before, and myself and one of the other Marines were just on top of the tower, just eyes on the entire area. It was a good vantage point, right? So as the squad got back into the area, there was two guys on a motorcycle that kind of rolled up and drove past him, and then there was an explosion as the guy in the back tossed a grenade, and that kicked everything off. And when it started, they were maybe 800-900 yards out. They weren't that far away. So, you know, Tucker and I, we had a 50 up there with us that the sniper platoon kindly let us borrow. So we had that up there with us in an M40, a 7.62 bolt gun. So we went to work just keeping the rooftops clear and taking out any targets of opportunity. And again, Murphy's Law, once again, all the radios went out the second time. You can't make this stuff up. The evening prior, they went out and then they were back up. They're working fine all morning. Once there's rounds in the air, they give it out again. So that kicked off, mid morning, and the QRF, or Quick Reaction Force, got called in from the north, and then they got hemmed up north, and there was some DARPA EOD type special device on one of the vehicles that was rolling in, unbeknownst to anybody, right? So when that section of the convoy went down, now priority was securing whatever was in that vehicle. Like, I didn't know this till after the fact, but I was wondering why the guys were pushing further north away from everybody when one of the heavier CAT teams, or combined anti-armor teams, rolled in. They had 50s Mark 19s on their up guns. They didn't know that we were on the tower, and they must have been 1,100 yards out. So anytime our 50s were going off to try to take out targets near them, one of the gunners on the M2 somehow picked this up and then started slinging 50 cals back at us. And this must have gone on for 15 minutes until one of the sergeants in my platoon realized what was going on. As the rounds were crashing into the oil tank, I'm sitting there like hoping that this giant, massive fuel air bomb that we're sitting on right now, that those, AP rounds that are coming in here don't penetrate this old tank and, cook us.
Cook off. Yeah, cook off, make a big explosion.
It didn't happen. And the day progressed further and further. And I think towards the end of the day, saw what I thought was three guys with a RPK or something slung across their shoulder. And I knew where our guys were because they'd kind of hunkered down in a little school building, and these guys were rolling up to get on the high point, right? So we just kept slamming rounds their way. But the round that did connect with those guys was probably the eighth round of the magazine. But that wouldn't look good for TV. So they made it the first round. But physics being physics, you put enough stuff in the air, something or somebody's bound to get hit.
You're on the oil tank, right? Which is about 1,600 meters away from these individuals you're talking about. And yeah. You have a Barrett 50 cal.
Right. Yeah. I mean, being on top of the tower, it's bouncing the shockwave and the muzzle blast like right back at you. So every round rolling down there was painful. But, keep pushing through. And then a nice thing too, Rain, with the rounds that we had mags full of Mark 211 Ralphus rounds. So those are high explosive, armor piercing, incendiary rounds. So if they hit anything semi-hard downrange, they spark. So we did have, we were able to pick up splashes most of the time. So again, just walk rounds onto targets. And I think by that time, we were almost bingo on 50 cal. And, trying to send 7.62 that far out was pointless. So we pulled off the tower, and at that point, we were the only two dudes in the entire oil field, which, that sixth sense, right? You get the hair going up in the back of your neck. So we walked over. We laid low for a little bit.
Everyone else pushed north, right?
Yeah. But the oil field there is, the refinery is surrounded and guarded by local armed Iraqis, assuming that they're good people, right? But so as sun's setting, Tucker and I were thinking, we've got to get out of here. So let's go over to the security office, jack the keys to one of the cars, and we'll just make our way back to the FOB. Yeah, so as we walked over to the security office, you could see that the six or seven guys there were very surprised to see two Marines come out, right? And Tucker's got the 40, the bolt gun, and I've got the 50 slung over my back. And they're looking at us, and they're looking for the other Marines. Like, we knew there's 30 or 40 of you here, but where's everybody else? So I immediately jump on my non-working radio and start, you know, talking to the other Marines that can't hear me. And I'm pointing at the rifle and then pointing at like space, you know, distant spots far off, and trying to get the Iraqis to see the other Marines over there with this big rifle. And then, you know, if you look over there, there's another one of these right there. Every wave, right? So just doing that for like 30 seconds changed the entire interaction with them. And I think it put them back on their heels. Like, all right, if we try to kill these two Americans because we outgunned them, you know, we're going to get killed like immediately. So
how far away was everyone else?
But that time when the sun set, they were maybe 2 miles north of us.
Again, they're pushing towards that vehicle, the DARPA vehicle.
Right.
That has a special device on it. That's the whole objective now.
Yeah. I mean, that was why they pushed up there. You know, we didn't know. So after we, you know, sorted the deal out with the guards at the field, here comes three Humvees pulling back into the oil field. You know, one of the Marines I knew and jumped in there and returned back to base that evening. And that was a slight kick in the nuts because one of the Marines and one of the other platoons, right? Like, I heard that he got killed in the engagement. Me being the platoon sergeant, when I got back to the FOB there, you know, I'm picking up my platoon's mail, and then right next to my stack is his platoon's mail, and there's a letter right on the top to Corporal Spear with like lipstick marks on it from his wife. And I'm like, damn, you know, she's gonna be getting a knock on the door in like 6 to 12 hours. That is not gonna be good.
Man, was he killed? I guess once they pushed forward north in town, you said he was another from another platoon, right? The one that joined your platoon. Am I tracking that?
Yeah, he was one of the Marines that came in after the quick reaction force got called.
Yeah, man.
I mean, but that kind of like set me, it made me wonder, right? Like if I, and you always have to get yourself, like if I could have done more from afar, or maybe hit that dude that shot, you know, would Spear be here today? So, you know, it's always like, all right, from that point on, more training, myself, the Marines, like balls to the walls, right? So after I got out, that was one of the main driving forces for starting a training company.
Yeah. So you, you're up there on that tank, which probably, and again, you're just doing Overwatch. And you mentioned you didn't have any formal training or in-depth training, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, I wasn't a Marine sniper. I mean, despite what some people in their basements may say. Yeah, I mean, I grew up shooting service rifle competition, long-range shooting, I mean, since I was 11. So, you know, being behind a rifle and figuring wind out at distance, not an overly complicated thing, especially when you have, you know, years behind the gun at distance. So,
Yeah, you say it's not complicated, but then you're able to kill someone from a mile away.
Again,
not something that
eighth round in the magazine, maybe.
Yeah. Well, it still counts. What, I mean, is a sniper not normally integrated into a platoon? Was there a reason why,
guys didn't have that? Way, I mean, I have no idea how it worked back then, but you had a sniper platoon in a battalion, and depending on what the operations were going on, they might take a team. Platoon would probably insert a team or two, you know, under the cover of darkness the day prior, just to get eyes on the area, kind of establish patterns for locals. And then once they've got that established, once your platoon is rolling into the area, they can easily identify if there's any shift in patterns, and, you know, they've got your back while you're there.
Yeah. So on that day, was it just kind of self-initiative saying, hey, it'd be helpful to have some armed overwatch?
That was
with a long gun
pitch to the guys. Like, hey, we're working out of this oil field for the week. Like, I know where you guys are tasked elsewhere. Like, if you don't have one of the 107s previously committed, can I take it with me? So, you know, no issues there.
Well, shift gears. Can you tell me what it's like getting blown up by an IED?
I think it was June or July of that summer. Yeah, I was the IEDs were constantly getting hit, right? So if we just lost another vehicle the day prior. So, you know, me being the platoon sergeant, like, I'm going to strategically put myself in like the fifth vehicle back in the convoy because that one will be safe, right? So we roll out mid morning and bomb goes off like a 155 artillery shell, maybe 6 feet away. I'm in the A driver and the Humvee and the doors at the time. It was those kind of half-assed semi-up armor ones where you had a giant hole where you could just hang your rifles out, right? The do-it-yourself armor kits. So,
yeah, this is pre-MRAP days. This is before.
Oh, yeah, yeah. There was no armor class. Everyone... It was, you know, strap-on armor, you know, Mickey Mouse. It did work, but just the way the bomb went off, all the fragmentation coming through that opening, you know, I hit my jacket, Kevlar, glasses, and mainly my head on the right side, you know, jacked me up considerably. Nobody else got hurt in the vehicle. My head stopped everything. but I remember,
thank you for your service.
Yeah, I remember getting knocked into the driver, and to our right, if you go off, you're going into the river and probably rolling the vehicle. And if you go left, we're going to roll the vehicle and go down the embankment there. So I'm like telling him to just stop the vehicle. And I get out and, you know, like right before I get out, I'm doing the system check. I'm like, all right, well, I can feel my toes. I got arms. I can see, and I can see a hole in my goggles. So I'm like, well, I'm seeing the hole, so we're good there. And then like starting to check all my teeth, jaw, like, you know, doing this in 5 seconds. Right. And I'm like, yeah, got a lot of blood coming out of my head and my mouth. Well, I'm good for now. So I get out, go to shoulder my rifle to shoot whoever is running away from the scene. Right. And I put it up there and it was just mush. Like, damn, there's a guy running over there and I can't get a good stock well, cheek well here because my face is jacked up. So Corman runs over and starts treating me. And anywho, got medevaced back to the FOB and then flown up to Baghdad, Germany, Bethesda, and that started the medical retirement process after that.
I love how you describe getting blown up and then just anywho, on with it. Any, I mean, obviously getting blown up, any kind of brain damage, or, I mean, was it just all lots of blood, flesh, tissue kind of?
No, scarring? I mean, I had my sinuses were shattered, skulls fractured, I forget where, jaw cracked, hearing damage, right ear, left ear, I got some fragments like behind my eye socket. I mean, luckily, I got a thick skull, so nothing went too far in, right? But other than that, you know, I'm still good. I couldn't count to 21 before, and I still can't figure out where 21 is now.
Again, I go back to, it's like, well, anywho, you know, I got blown up, no big deal. Gosh.
Yeah, I mean, my grandfather, and that goes back to World War II, right? Like, he got shot in the neck from like 50 yards out, and, you know, ever since I was little, he's like, well, you know, at least nobody's shooting at you and you're alive, so you're good. And I remember thinking of him like, well, here I am. I'm alive, so I'm good, right? I mean, dwelling on it or thinking, you know, poor is me, not going to do anything.
Yeah, that's, I don't know if it's just the media or what it might be in life. It seems like that's kind of the general mentality of things today, right? Like, you have every right and every excuse to be, poor, pitiful me, I got blown up, but you're 180 degrees out and you are just going out there and crushing things in life. What drives you? I mean, is it the fact that your grandfather and you have that history there knowing, hey, just suck it up, buttercup, and like it could be worse?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was it growing up with that. And I'm like, I mean, just my personality in general, if there's nothing you can do about it, then don't dwell on it. Don't complain about it. You know, always improve your position to make things better for you and those around you.
Yeah, that's spot on. I think that's, again, you have the easy out and you're definitely not taking it. And hearing that, hopefully, yeah, I mean, everyone's struggling with something, you know, in the end, you're not getting shot at and blown up, which probably most people listen
to. Yeah, and
to
I'm
this,
not, so. Not knocking the guys that are always like, that always have their hand out, like, poor as me, or like, I'm a disabled veteran. I'm like, just by you saying that, you are mentally, like, you're lowering yourself compared to everybody else. You are leading a conversation with, I'm a disabled veteran. Like, unless you're missing both legs. I'm not bashing everybody, but like, you know, my friend Clint Trial, you follow him on IG, you know, active duty Marine, lost both legs last year. That guy's still out there leaning forward, balls to the walls still, right?
Yeah.
Like, and he's got as a valid excuse as anybody to just sit down and take a breather and, you know, let other people take care of things. But he's not. He's forward leaning. And I think everybody should be, you know. Again, take care of yourself and do what you can for others too.
That's inspiring to hear that. How was the transition coming back to this? What was it, a difficult transition coming back to the United States and getting medically retired?
No, I mean, I found it kind of, it was easy. I mean, it was, just like you, I'm sure in your first deployment, you get back to the US and it's like, wow, America, you know?
Yeah.
It wasn't hard at all, but you know, I was driven to focus on training and learn what the cool guys, so to speak, do for training, because I wanted to start a training company at some point. So I started moonlighting at Blackwater and it was up there for a good year. Thought it could be done better, right? After just objectively looking at everything, customer service, the way things work, the level of training, and student to instructor ratios, et cetera. So started kind of looking for who might be willing to dump gas on this fire, right? Who's a patriotic American that actually has disposable income to do another training company the size of Blackwater out of the gate, not start as some mom and pop shop. So I think a month later, number two at Blackwater at the time, former SEAL, awesome guy, like heart of gold. He called me into his office in their new $6 million admin building and sat me down. He's like, hey, Steve, there's been six or seven other guys that, like you, think you can go out and do this better. You know, I got word through the grapevine that you're looking to start your own company. So we can't have you working here while looking to do the same thing. And I hope you understand. I'm like, I've got it, fully understand. So, you know, he thanked me for everything I've done and, you know, wished me well, but it was like, you're going to fail just like everybody else did. You can't beat us. So fast forward a year, right, Rain? And the guy that bankrolled Tier 1 Group, my company, is now looking to buy Blackwater. And we sit down at the boardroom, which is massive. So, and a few minutes later, the whole Blackwater entourage rolls in, Cofer Black, Prince, Gary Jackson, and they all sit down right across from me. And then Gary looks up, he sees me, and he just starts laughing. I'm like, back.
Steve, I love it. I mean, that right there, I mean, if, for those who don't know, I mean, I think everyone knows the name Blackwater, but Blackwater, the behemoth, I don't know how many millions and millions of dollars of business they're doing with the government, but I mean, it's a, that is a David versus Goliath type scenario there. And I guess not being intimidated.
So, I mean, I was able to get T1G to the size of Blackwater just on the training side in 5 years.
Can you talk about what you're doing now or no?
Just supporting different folks in and around DC. I mean, it's kind of hard. I normally just tell people I'm a plumber because that kind of like ends the conversation and nobody really cares about a plumber. So
yeah,
not bashing any plumbers out there, but just like, okay, I know what you do for a living. So
yeah, there's, you don't have to explain it.
Yeah, it's interesting. The nice thing now is I'm nimble enough now that I've, the Brothers in Arms Foundation, if something pops up, I can jump on it and just take care of it and devote a week's worth of time or however much time is needed. And then, allow me to establish Raider Air, which is a, subcategory of Brothers in Arms Foundation. So Raider Air is taking guys like yourself, you know, pilots on the civilian side that have aircraft or the capabilities to fly other people's aircraft. And
yeah, that's incredible. Leveraging the network. I love it. Everything you've done, man, it is an incredible journey. Just really a matter of 2 decades. You've done a bunch of stuff and still doing a lot of great work. Yeah,
I mean, it's fun. And I met you too. I mean, that's freaking highlight of life, right?
I don't know about that. The bar is pretty low there. We need to find you some new hobbies or something.
I mean, but no, that's true. Sit in your plane once and I was like, this is awesome. This guy gets to do this for a living. Where do I sign up?
No, I think that is the one thing. It's funny. I think, you know, you get a lot of people that ask you advice. And I think it is like one of the things you don't realize when you're young, but like every person you come in contact with, like there's going to be a lot of chaff out there. Like you'll never interact with them again. But then you know, if you meet everyone and you put forth your best foot and your best energy, you never know what relationship that's going to develop. And my, you know, definitely the time on the air show circuit for me was one where you just come across people from all walks of life and, you know, you build friendships and you build a network. And again, if you don't put forth effort, it's never going to happen. And I think that's
correct.
That's the big takeaway is you got to put forth effort and, then if you be a good person, be a good dude or dudette, like you just never know where it's going to lead and the relationships you're going to build and what the journey is going to become.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's fun. I still haven't figured out what I want to do when I grow up, but I'm not growing up anytime soon.
Dude.
Yeah.
Steve, thanks for giving me an hour plus of your time. I know you got a few things rolling, so it was good to catch up.
Yeah, no, I mean, happy to help and wish you success with the podcast. And yeah, it's been fun.
Yeah, likewise. Steve, again, I appreciate you taking the time to come on here today. I hope everyone enjoyed the interview. There is a special question and answer session up there on patreon.com/theafterburn podcast for those at the patch and director ops level. If you're looking for additional content, swing over to patreon.com. Again, if you're enjoying this podcast, hit subscribe, leave me a review. See you in 2 weeks with Shiv Wilton, the A-10 demo pilot. But until then, don't bring a week.
Baseball fans, BetMGM is giving you the chance to win a prize every day during the baseball season. Step into the batter's box for BetMGM's Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. Pick any area of the strike zone and take your best swing. If you get a single, double, triple, or home run, you'll receive a prize. Smash a home run to collect a bonus bet on us. Just log into your BetMGM sports account to get started. Then visit your promotion section to access the Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. You'll score a prize if you hit a single, double, triple, or home run. There's nothing more exciting than going yard, so swing for the fences with the king of sportsbooks. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. Must be 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards vary depending on the market and expire 24 hours from issuance. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.